Welcome, and it's wonderful to see your faces. There are several scenes from Torah that leave vivid images in our minds. I think of Adam and Eve eating the apple, responding with shame to God's voice, and being expelled from the Garden of Eden. Cain's rejection by God and retaliation in striking his brother dead. Noah loading the animals onto the ark, sending out a raven and then a dove, and waiting to see if the birds would return. I imagine the scene at the Tower of Babel and people being dispersed. In last week's Torah reading, we could imagine Abraham listening to the voice that tells him, Lech lecha, you go forth from your land, from your people, from your father's house to a land that I will show you. This week's Torah reading, Vayera, is rich in dramatic scenes. Abraham sitting at the opening of his tent, rushing out to welcome the three messengers, begging them to rest, offering to wash their feet, serving them cream and milk and bread. Sarah laughing in the tent. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh raining down fire and brimstone on Saddam, and Lot's wife turning to a pillar of salt. Sarah insisting that Hagar and Ishmael be expelled, Hagar weeping at some distance from her son, not seeing the well of water that had sprung up to revive him. And then Abraham, listening to a voice that tells him once again, leave the place where you are. But this time it begins with, Kach na, pray, take your son, your only one whom you love, Yitzhak. And here again, the words lech lecha are used. Abraham hears these words again, go forth, this time to the land of Moriah, the land of seeing. And offer him up there as an offering up, an olah, that's an offering that is completely consumed by fire as it rises up. There on a mountain that I will show you, same type of leaving and going on a journey to a place that you will discover only when you get there. And there is the trek up the mountain, the altar with the wood they have carried, and the sudden appearance of the ram. How do you envision these scenes? Well, it's forbidden to represent God in a material, concrete form, according to interpretations of the first commandment. Nevertheless, artists throughout the centuries have represented scenes from Torah in a variety of ways that may shape our imagination. I've spent a bit more time than usual these past 2 weeks reflecting on my own mental representations of scenes of Torah, literature, and theater, because I'm taking a wonderful class offered by TBZ member and director Judy Epstein Fisher, a class called Delving Deep, a theatrical adventure into plays focused on the Jewish family. Well, it struck me that Torah, particularly the books of Genesis and Exodus, offer a series of dramatic episodes all focused on Jewish families, including intense themes of fratricide and filicide. I found it particularly helpful to reflect on the questions that Judy gives us to guide our exploration of these plays. What are the givens and what is inferred? What does the script actually tell you? What do you see and know, and what do you infer? In the first play we read, memory and imagination take place in scenes that have special lighting and staging to let us know when imagination slips into memory and then merges back into the present-day lives of the characters. Torah has both givens, the pshat, the storyline, and large gaps filled in with midrash, much of it creative and playfully unbound. We'll go back and take a look at a specific midrash. And the second question, what is the journey each character makes from the beginning to the end of each scene and each play? Abraham is sent off on several actual journeys in the parshiot of the last 2 weeks, of last week and this week, two of which both begin with the emphasis on leave-taking, lech lecha. And as Reggie reflected on last week, there are many interpretations of what this repetition, lech lecha, of the two words may mean, and the alternate meaning of lecha, to yourself, for yourself, leave to go into yourself, toward yourself. Could this describe the way each of us has to leave a place of comfort and routine in order to discover what we need to become, how we can come into our own, so to speak, our own transformative journey? So last week, together, we reflected on the beginning part of the journey that Abraham makes, then Avram makes in response to being told, lech lecha. And this week, we'll look at the meaning of this second journey, a three-day trek up to Mount Moriah, the place of seeing. How would you, as a director, stage the scenes that represent fantasy, memory, or actual interactions? How would you imagine the scenes of conversations between Abraham and God, between Abraham and Isaac, between Abraham and Sarah? What makes a play such a wonderful, powerful form of communication? So many things. Speaking from a psychological perspective, first, when we go into the theater, or imagine being in a theater, we're in a separate space, a space that's separate from our day-to-day lives. It's a play space where anything can be enacted, and it's all pretend. You can kill off people who don't really die. You can create things that never really exist. So it gives free rein to act out fantasies and impulses over which we would otherwise have to exercise great restraint, because we don't want the real consequences of everything we might imagine or wish or think of. Not only are we in a special play space, but also the characters offer us people and situations we can identify with. We are given an opportunity to imagine ourselves as other people. They might seem exactly like us, so we feel validated, not alone. They might seem totally different, so we can explore ways of thinking or feeling that we never thought of before. They might offer us relief by acting out angry or shameful feelings or impulses for us, so we can vicariously experience the enactment of these impulses that we would never act on in real life. They can allow us to feel joy or despair or tragic loss that we may have been trying to hold in check, afraid of being overwhelmed by it in the midst of our real lives. But when another character goes through something on stage, it may offer us a safe space to deeply feel the emotions that we've been trying to manage and restrain. It can feel safer to feel the depths of sorrow in a creative play space than in our actual lives. So it can help us get in touch with what we actually may feel, but be afraid to know, until the play, or in this case, Torah and Midrash, offer us an opening to those feelings, a safer space to feel those feelings. So with this perspective, let's look at the dramatic events that unfold in this week's Parsha. Together, we can look at the story of the binding of Isaac, enriched by a wonderful commentary of Aviva Zornberg. First, Zornberg draws our attention to the words God uses in calling to Abraham, Kach na et bincha, which Everett Fox translates as, pray, take your son. Na, the word that makes this not a command, but a prayer, a request, it's an odd word for God to use. It's a word that Abraham, in his gentleness and kindness, uses often. But God did not use the word na in his initial lech lecha. He didn't say lech lecha na. So here, the communication comes across more as a proposal, a request. It's a halting request that comes out in bits and pieces. Your son, your only son, whom you love, Yitzhak. As if these steps, it's taking a while for Abraham to hear or understand the message, and it launches him on a journey, a 3-day journey of allowing this command to be part of his inner world. So what is this inner journey that Abraham has to make in responding to God's request? Abraham does not respond quickly. He neither rejects the idea immediately, as horrifying as I think most of us would do, a horrifying and complete betrayal of everything that God had promised, nor does he immediately jump to fulfill the request. In contrast to the way he just jumped up to welcome the three guests without even thinking about it. That is his mission, to care for others. But here he has to take both an inner journey and a literal journey. So early the next morning, Abraham saddled his ass, this is the actual in Torah, and took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. He split the wood for the burnt offering, and he set out for the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place from afar. On this journey of 3 days, what is Abraham thinking? Here, the big gaps in the story, the absence of the inner workings of Abraham's mind, are provided by Rashi's commentary that draws on ancient Midrash. The Midrash is based on a given fact that we read at the end of Parsha Noah. So this is one of the givens, not an inference. So you may remember that at the end of Parsha Noah, there's a long set of begats and begats, and the lineages are described in the post-Babel world, including, now this is the line of Terach. Terach begat Avram, Nahor, and Haran begat Lot. Haran died in the lifetime of his father, Terach. Al pene Terach aviv, translated as before Terach, his father. But Rashi writes, this al-pnei Terach aviv, in the presence of his father, meaning during the lifetime of his father, that there is also a midrashic explanation that he actually died through his father, through the actions of his father. So many of us are familiar with the story of Avram, even as a young child, recognizing that these idols were meaningless, and his father's business was, he was an idol maker. He had a shop full of inventory of idols. And when Avram smashed the idols, understanding that there's only one creative force in the universe, one force with that power of creativity of the world, that Terach accused Avram before the king, Nimrod, of having smashed his idols to pieces. And Nimrod cast Avram into a fiery furnace. And meanwhile, Brother Haran was waiting to figure out how to choose sides. Haran said to himself, "If Avram proves triumphant, I will be on his side. If Nimrod wins, I shall be on his." And miraculously, Avram came out of the fiery furnace alive. When Avram was saved, they said to Haran, "Whose side are you on?" And Haran replied, "I'm on Avram's side." They therefore cast him into the fiery furnace, but he was burnt to death. A horrible story. Rashi brings Abraham's traumatic past to the surface to help us understand the journey he is taking. It's not clear whether Abraham literally remembers this traumatic event. Of course, time is always confusing in Torah because the Midrash is that this happened when Avram was a boy. So you'd think Haran might have also been young, but then Haran had already had a son, Lot, Avram's nephew. So time is confusing. But so we could say is memory and the mind. So it's not clear whether Avram literally remembers this traumatic event described in Midrash, his own near death at the hands of his father, being saved miraculously at the last moment. Yet, as Aviva Zornberg explains, Abraham is still under the heavy influence of this memory, having experienced this trauma that he may or may not consciously remember. He finds himself somehow compelled to enact with his own son what was done to him. The Torah story seems to echo modern psychological understanding of trauma, that those who are traumatized may find themselves unwittingly, unintentionally enacting some aspect of the experience, either as victim or perpetrator. Abraham finds himself so under the influence of the past, so compelled that he does not immediately notice or respond to the messenger of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, who calls out his name, Avraham, Avraham. The messenger needs to call the name two times, and the names are written with a line, a vertical line in between, dividing them as if to signify the two different states of mind of Avraham. First, Avraham in a trance-like state, compelled to reenact his own traumatic memory, and the second, Avraham, back in the world, no longer lost in his inner world, responsive, able to look up and see that there is a ram in the bush for the sacrifice. The journey of recovery of memory, and perhaps recovery of sanity, that Abraham must make in this story is a lifelong journey that culminates in a millisecond between the first and second times the angel calls Avraham. He wakes up from the confusion of his mind only after life events and God forced him to get in touch with the emotions that may have been inaccessible to him. A process that we know is a painful but necessary part of recovery for so many people. So how might we identify with Avraham, the main character in this drama, as we watch him struggle with his horrifying assignment. Like Avraham, we often intend to be generous, to live our values, and to do the right thing. Yet, we sometimes have trouble recognizing when our adherence to pursuing our mission, our sense of doing the right thing, we sometimes have trouble recognizing when there may be some harm from the way we're pursuing this. Could our mission be based on a misinterpretation or on our own compulsions to work through past events that we may not be aware of? Can our meditation practice help us to see through the veil of these machinations of our mind, our thoughts, dreams, and fantasies, our tendency to get carried away with our missions without clearly seeing what we're doing? Can we sit in silence and appreciate the torrent of thoughts that cascade through our minds and learn that many of these thoughts come and go, often clouding the truth of our compassionate nature? But then there are breaks in the clouds and our compassionate nature can shine through. So circling back, how did Torah study and Midrash, theater and meditation share certain qualities, and how do these very different pursuits highlight the transformative nature of each? All three of these provide us with a sacred play space, a place where we can creatively play with the ideas, fantasies, and impulses that arise that we often push away into a dark, hidden corner. While imaginative midrash and theater may more obviously create such a play space, I include meditation perhaps because of a comment made by my teacher, Larry Rosenberg, years ago, as he invited us to meditate together, saying, as I did today, sit back and watch the show of what goes on in the mind, while we aren't putting any effort into controlling what arises. Of course, there are obvious connections to psychoanalysis and the use of free association, but also differences, and that could be several other talks that we could have at other times. All three spaces, Torah study, theater, and meditation, give us permission to see what is really on our minds. In these spaces, the roles that restrict and focus us, the effort that keeps impulses, fantasies, and memories hidden from us, are unbound and free to appear in a space where we are not actually acting on them. In these ways, these creative play spaces allow us to see and process what is often hidden, but nevertheless controlling our behavior. Our teacher Aviva Zornberg highlights the importance of these processes, of seeing the hidden forces that control us, in her teaching on the Akedah that I've been reflecting on. And this is a recording that's on YouTube made by Beit Avichai in 2020, 4 years ago. Akedah means binding or binding for sacrificial offering, and usually it refers to Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac. Zornberg, however, draws our attention to the inner world of Abraham's troubled mind. Giving the title of her talk on this parsha, Abraham, Bound and Unbound. May our many portals into our inner world, Torah, theater, meditation, poetry, art, play, bring us into greater awareness of the hidden forces that compel and bind us.